Hey there, if you're listening to this and you support us on Patreon, you can hear it via the Patreon page ad-free.
Who took the bomb?
You're listening to Sound Opinions, and this week we're talking with Yola about her incredible new album, Stand For Myself. I'm Greg Kot.
And I'm Jim DeRogatis. But first, Greg, we have to pay tribute to one of the greatest drummers in the history of rock and roll, Charlie Watts. One of the greatest drummers in the history of rock and roll, Charlie Watts. Charlie died on August 24th at the age of 80. Greg, people who follow music news know that a Rolling Stones tour was supposed to start September 26th in St. Louis. Don't know yet what's happening with that as we record this on the day of Charlie's death. But Charlie wasn't going to play. He was, quote, ill. He was recovering after a medical procedure. There was no indication that Charlie was terminally ill or anything like that. Mm-hmm. In fact, he was a force of nature. That is a cliche. But even though you are not a drummer, and I am, I think if you went back to the two or three dozen Rolling Stone concert reviews that both of us have done over the years, every single one focuses in on that left hand coming down on the snare. Frail, gentlemanly jazz bow, right? You know, impeccably dressed, sitting at a small kit right in Shea Stadium, in Soldier Field, and that left hand comes down on two and four, and the stadium shakes.
Yeah.
That was Charlie.
Yeah, the one thing when you'd watch Charlie drum is that typically a lot of rock drummers, you know, they come above the shoulders and slam mm-hmm. those drums. You know, it's rock, man. Yeah. I'm, you know, yeah. going to pound the crap out of these things.
Oh, and it's like an athletic fest.
And Charlie was very refined back there. He was, you know, he reminded me of a jazz drummer like Kenny Clarke. You know, it was very erect bearing. You know, that grip on the sticks was a jazz grip.
Traditional grip,
you know,
they call
it.
It
was like all in the wrists. And man, you go, like, how does he get that huge sound from that little, almost minimalist motion on the drums?
And the minimalist kit. Charlie's playing this little jazz set. And, you know, as important as his left hand on the snare is his right foot on the bass drum, like I said, rocking stadiums. You know, a fascinating man. I don't know if you ever interviewed him. I got to tell my story. The only good thing that happened in my 8.5 months at Rolling Stone is in 1996, I got to sit with Charlie Watts at the Peninsula Hotel in New York and have tea. 3-hour tea, you know, the English kind of tea, right? With the little stand of little mini cucumber sandwiches. And my God, what a wonderful storyteller, a self-effacing man. He would have been married to his wife, Shirley, 57 years in October. You know, he was not a rock star in any sense of the word of behaving like a jerk, although we only learned several years ago that in the decadent period of Exile on Main Street and such, he had his own heroin addiction, just like Keith, right? You know, but we talked about jazz. We talked about, you know, he was touring with a big band at that point, and he loved doing it. He was playing smaller clubs. He was not playing stadiums, and he was following his passion, and that is where he started. We also talked, and I got this. I'm going to have this as one of my proudest possessions until the day I die. I got him to sign his illustrated children's book, Ode to a High-Flying Bird. He started out as a jazz fan, a jazz musician, and an illustrator, and he did this wonderful children's book in the early 60s, before the Stones mattered to anybody, where Charlie Parker, one of his heroes, is portrayed as a tiny little lovable Bird, and he tells the story of Charlie Parker in mm-hmm. a children's book. And having Charlie's signature on that, man, you know, it was just like the most civilized conversation ever. But that brings us to where he started. Tell us about where he came from.
Well, I mean, he started out as a jazz drummer. I mean, R&B even was like, is that just slow Charlie Parker? He wasn't really sure what that was. Got involved in blues bands because there's a similarity. Obviously, blues and jazz share a lot of characteristics. And his approach to rock drumming was from a jazz man's perspective. So it was a swing sense that he brought to it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people talk about the band. I mean, you know, he, Mick Jagger and Keith Richards were the only three members of the Rolling Stones to this day that have played on every Rolling Stones record.
Yeah.
They are the three key members of the band in many ways. Although everybody puts the relationship between Mick and Keith as the key relationship in the band, I think the relationship between Keith Richards and Charlie Watts is equally, if not in many ways, more important because of the sense of swing that those two, the dynamic between those two. You know, we talked about how many Stone shows we'd cover. Watching the interplay between Charlie and Keith was the show for me.
Keith was looking at Charlie
half the time.
Yeah, I mean, I learned that from you. We learn things from each other as critics, even after all of these years. The appreciation you always had in watching those two and the way they moved and the way they interacted, it taught me. It gave me another reason to appreciate Charlie. Tell the greatest story ever about Charlie and Mick Jagger.
Well, it was one of those endless Stones tours. They're on the road. They're staying at a nice hotel, obviously.
Of course.
They're staying on different floors. You know, they're all hanging out in their suites and things like this. They roll in 3 or 4 in the morning. And Charlie's a civilized man. He's ready for bed. I'm going to bed, you know. I'll see you guys later. Mick is having a couple of drinks. He's feeling himself. You know, I'm the guy. You know, I'm the man. I want to jam.
It's his band.
Where's my drummer?
His band. Right.
Where's my drummer? He calls Charlie's room. Where's my drummer? I need him immediately, you know. And he's summoning Charlie Watts to his room. So no answer. You know, the phone hangs up, you know, but he's left this message.
Mm-hmm.
And the next thing you know, Charlie shows up in a suit in cologne.
Yeah.
Keith said that he could smell the cologne as he walked in the door.
He gets out of bed.
Yes.
He dresses.
He shaves.
He grooms himself. Yes.
He's ready to, you know, suddenly he's out for another night. He walks past Keith. Keith answers the door. He walks past Keith, grabs Mick Jagger by the lapels. I'm not your effing drummer. Uppercut, sends him flying into a plate of salmon and apparently ready to tumble out the window into this Amsterdam canal.
Yeah.
And Keith at the last minute grabs him. Charlie, 12 hours later, is still steaming. He's still pissed at Mick for summoning him this way. He says, well, I just saved the bugger. He said, well, you were wearing my suit. I needed to save it, Keith said.
Oh, you're my singer. I am not your drummer. But in many ways, I believe Charlie Watts was the soul of the Rolling Stones. Can they continue without him? Led Zeppelin couldn't continue without John Bonham. Keith many times has said, when Charlie is done, the Stones are done.
Yeah.
That remains to be seen. Maybe we'll get news after this recording. Maybe we won't. What matters today is remembering this great man. We're each going to play a song that highlights the things that we think Charlie Watts brought to the Rolling Stones. You know, to his credit, one of the things he brought is he'd rather us play one of his big band jazz recordings.
Yeah, right.
All right. But that Rolling Stones band, you know, made some news for decades. We got to do the Stones. What song would you say epitomizes Charlie Watts?
Well, you know, I don't know if it epitomizes him, but I think he was extremely undervalued. People thought he was just, you know, he was keeping the beat. You know, it was more than keeping the beat. It was their sense of swing, that jazz sensibility, that feel for what the song needed, each song needed. And Charlie played just the right thing every time. Even when the Stones got sort of low-key and sensitive and emotional, Charlie was there in a perfect way. I think one of the most radical tracks in the Stones catalog recorded during their heyday was Moonlight Mile.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound like anything else in their discography. And it is a great example of intimacy from the Stones, which is one of their traits that is rarely appreciated. Nobody really thinks of them that, in those terms.
No, it's all about strut.
But this was a late night session where Keith was not at this session. It was basically boiled down to Mick Jagger, Mick Taylor, and Charlie Watts. And they created this beautiful track about road weariness, sung at a kind of a hushed level. Charlie playing mallets on the drums. The washes of cymbals, the way he was handling those toms, it was an orchestral kind of approach to drumming.
He was playing
very intimate track.
Mallets.
Yeah, it was incredibly sensitive drumming. The versatility of Watts to say, okay, I'm going to go use this kind of touch for what this song, because that's what this particular song needs. And I still think it's one of the most haunting, beautiful things the Stones have ever done. Charlie Watts on Moonlight Mile from the Sticky Fingers record in 1971.
Sound of strangers sending nothing to my mind. Just another mad, mad day on the road. I am just living.
That is Moonlight Mile from the Rolling Stones, Charlie Watts playing those beautiful mallets on the toms and the washes on that cymbal, just giving it an incredibly beautiful atmosphere. Jim, what do you got for a Charlie Watts track that you want to play?
Well, one of the criticisms of Charlie from people who I think are completely ignorant and possibly don't actually have ears is that he was sloppy. He sped up. He slowed down. He always played minimally in the sense that he played exactly what the song required and not a note or fill more. When Keith rips loose with a solo, Charlie speeds up. When there's a dramatic pause, Charlie slows down. This is not what a drum machine, this is not what an 808 does, right? You know, and everything's metronomic. Charlie's in the moment, Charlie's feeling it. Listen to what the drums are doing, where they're going, speeding up, slowing down in Honky Tonk Women. It's recorded in 1969, released as a single, just a single. Didn't appear on an album. The Stones were at the height of their power, and Charlie is the height of the Stones' power. I always thought when I was a kid, this is the song I learned to play Charlie Watts drums. I thought he was playing both the cowbell and the drums, but it wasn't. It was producer Jimmy Miller on the cowbell. That Miller just augmented that odd syncopation that Charlie was already doing. You know, boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap, right? You know, and that gives Keith's riff its power. It's a great song, man. It's just as good as rock and roll gets.
She had to pee.
Now it's your turn to chime in about the great Charlie Watts. Leave us a voice message on our website, soundopinions.org, or start a thread in our Facebook group. Next up, we have a conversation with Yola on Sound Opinions.
I was a freedom rider when we thought the South had won. Virginia in the spring of 61.
That's a little bit of Yola, the title track of the High Women album from 2019. That supergroup of Brandi Carlile, Amanda Shires, Maren Morris, and Natalie Hemby may have introduced Yola to many listeners. It came out the same year as her solo debut, Walk Through Fire. That album and her contribution to the High Women presented an artist at a really interesting and surprising intersection: Black, British, and classic country. She made a huge impact at South by Southwest, Greg. I remember you telling me how blown away you were by her performance there.
Well, that's right, Jim. I mean, I remember seeing her up there with just a guitar and that voice, and wow, did she fill the room. I mean, it was amazing. She wound up nominated for the Best New Artist Grammy in 2020, but when her album Stand For Myself was released about a month ago, it became clear that Yola isn't going to be contained by any box people try to put her in.
Yola, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a real joy to be here.
Well, we are huge fans of your music, and congrats on this new album, Stand For Myself. It is truly, I think, an accomplishment. But I want to start at the beginning. You know, you have, in every interview, said you have loved singing. It has been your driving passion in life since you were really small. But growing up in Bristol, your mom was against the idea of you singing. You had to, like, do it on the sly.
So I grew up in a small town outside of Bristol, Portishead, for the first, like, good 10, 11 years of my life. I spent all of my time in this small town. I was one of, like, five black people in the area, and we didn't have a car. So that isolation meant that I leant into music so much more, because, like, that's where I saw people that looked like me that were speaking on things that I felt. And so that was a really big part of my childhood, was that feeling a bit less alone through listening to artists talk about their music and listen to their music and the lyrics and the melody and have that speak to me as a fellow member of the diaspora in a small town in England.
Music can be a lifeline, right? I mean, it sounds like here was something you could grasp onto that was giving you sustenance and inspiration. Were there any particular artists that, or voices or songs that really kind of connected? Were there light bulb moments like, oh, this is amazing, to the point where you say, I got to do this?
Yeah, I think I was so enamored with the songwriting element of music. And so I remember seeing Dolly and being like, wow, like, she really is in charge of what she's doing. And she's clearly fought for that. And I'm really impressed by what she's able to do. And watching Aretha play piano and sing and being like, wow, okay, I think I have to do this now. okay, so you can do that. Okay, that's blowing my mind. I'm like, but who sounds like me? Neither of those people sound like me. And then I saw Tina. And Tina had the smooth and the gruff. And I was like, okay, I get it now. Okay. So I've got a bit of that in my voice. Okay, so that's going to help me understand who I am. And I spent a lot of time listening to hip hop because of the era as well, and R&B of the era. And Mary J. Blige had the smooth and the gruff, and she knew how to give energy when it was time to give energy. And so many people of the era were singing like super smooth, like Aaliyah and all these people. And right. I was like, that's not, I can sing smooth, but like, if you get me enough power, it starts breaking up. And so I was like, okay, so in lots of different spaces, you can have these voices. And I suppose when I, in the early 90s, you had like Brownstone and all these kind of church vocal groups, like the vocal group was like massive. And like, they all could sing the living daylights out of a song. And of course, like, The Score came out, the whole Fugees thing, and D'Angelo was out. And so it was like very artsy. It felt like a very artsy Renaissance time to be kind of becoming aware of music, and also seeing like the sampling era, and like how people would be leaning into Smokey and Funkadelic and all of this kind of stuff in the era that I was growing up, at the same time as my mum loving country music as well. And so me getting into Shania and Dolly and into Emmylou and into this stuff, and also into Britpop. I just adored Blur and Damon Albarn. So that was the British kind of melting pot. We got a lot of stuff from America, but then we had this big Britpop revolution as well. So I was like into that.
I'm so glad to hear you say Blur. I mean, the fundamental divide among people are Blur versus Oasis, right?
Yeah.
And I love the Blur people.
Yes, Yola. Yes, yes. Yes, I'm Blur People. Oh.
I want to ask you about two other names that come up often when you're talking. One fairly current and one historical. I'll start with the historical. My partner, Mr. Codd, is too modest to bring this up, but he wrote a brilliant biography of Mavis Staples.
Yes!
And how that music fueled the civil rights movement. And I've seen you name drop Mavis Staples.
Yes, definitely.
What did she mean to you in particular?
So Mavis, again, me finding spaces where the gravel in the voice is celebrated because of the era that I was brought up in and that whole, you know, the popifying of the voice started to become the smoothing out of the voice. And if you were brought up in church or whatever, I wasn't, but like, you know, for people that were, they would find that people were trying to kind of strip the kind of foundation of what they understood to be singing out of it to kind of homogenize and maybe even to a point whitewash. And I found that somewhat harrowing. And so I gravitated towards people that had a little bit of the gravel in and helped me understand how to use my voice and how to lean into that part of my voice. And I think I really learned a lot from Mavis on how to make the most of that part of my voice, how to like celebrate it and uplift it when it's time to do that, you know. And I remember hearing her sing "Hear My Call Here," and it was so soft, and it was not like you know her voice to be like most commonly nowadays, like she was just so smooth. It was like, "I wonder," and it was just so like pillowy soft. But then the next song, she's like, "Okay, here it comes. I'm going to get the revs up." And so,
you know,
I learned so much from her. And she taught me that the gradual kind of like, not every song needs it. Not every song needs 100%.
Right.
And also like writing something that you feel like you can stand by, she feels a way and she kind of like really manifests that, and she'll sing it again and again and be like, "No, I still feel like this," you know? And I love that.
She told me a few times, I can't sing it unless I'm totally 100% invested in what I'm singing. I mean, not every word had to matter to her. And I got the sense you got your foot in the door in the music world as a singer for DJs and stuff like that, producers, right?
Massive Attack.
Yeah. And I read a few interviews with you, which were really great about, you know, you felt like you were getting pushed into this 20 feet from stardom role where you were going to be kind of somebody's, you're always going to be working for somebody.
Yeah.
And that, when did you sort of pick up, okay, this is good, but I need some more of that Missy Elliott, I can control.
I got to be the boss.
The whole project vibe. When did that sort of click in?
The dance music front person for hire. Dancing, da-da-da-da-da-da. And then just like sashay off. Kind of situation was like always like a placeholder for me. It was like the trope of black lady singing house music was a thing in America, and we didn't necessarily have the volume of singers that sang in that kind of way in the UK. And so my voice was somewhat of an oddity. It didn't fit into the jazz scene necessarily as much. Although I sang a whole lot of Ella growing up, and that was probably the closest I got because Ella had some gravel. She was sneaky like that. I love me some Ella.
Sure.
I love me some Ella. Ella got it. She got it in spades. But it was like always trying to find a spot, and like people were like, "Wow, you've got the gravelly thing. You can do the big kind of screaming notes and that." And I'm like, "Yeah." And they're like, "We don't have a lot of people that can do that in England." I'm like, "Really? Cool. Well, I suppose I better do that and start charging, you know?" Like. Because, you know, like, who else else are you going to ask? They'd be like, oh, I don't know if I want to play that. I'm like, well, feel free to ask someone else. Good luck with that. I was just trying to ride that pony all the way to the bank for a while. But I just, like, you know, it was soul destroying. It's got to be real. Like, some people I work with, I love them as people, but I was like, this music isn't speaking to me. Sometimes I got into a situation where it was kind of dancey, but also kind of like soulful. And I was like, I really love this music, but what they need from my voice is different. They need me to be like maybe more of that clean sound or more of a nasal sound or just whatever I'm not. And everywhere I was just somewhere, something that I'm not. And so I tried to kind of set up a situation in my hometown with some players and form a band. And like, we did that for a while, but the idea of me being the boss was something I was terrified about.
I draw the line with the emptiness filling my shadow. You're the only.
My mother died of motor neurones disease. And as I was watching her go down into the ground in her casket, the casket looked small and it looked like it was a joke. We had a difficult relationship. She had all the tenements of a clinical psychopath and functioned wonderfully in society. Society rewards those traits a lot of the time. But she wasn't great with empathy. And so I was more thinking of the whirlwind that was her personality and how it boiled down into this somewhat pitiful box that could never quite compensate for what was lost. And I was like, this is not a dress rehearsal and I've got to get on it. And I decided to pursue picking up the guitar more, playing more guitar and actually committing myself to learning it. I decided to start writing songs again. I hadn't been inspired to write songs for a while. Even like up until like 2011 might have been the last time that I wrote a song. And so then I was just like in this real like state of being uninspired, like a writing block. And I just felt freed in that moment that I just had to. And so, yeah, I was riding on my motorcycle home because I've been a biker my whole life or a cyclist.
Why is that not a surprise, Greg?
No, yeah. I get that.
And I was riding home and a bass line came into my head and it went. I was like, this is a weird bass line to get the evening of your mother's funeral. It's a bit party, isn't it? But it kept coming. Anyway, so anyway, I arrive home and the lyrics start arriving and it's the song on the album, Break the Bow. Started coming into fruition at that evening. And I only realized that when we were putting it together and I was like, I've always been writing this album.
Wow.
Well, the recurring theme of Stand For Myself is about asserting your identity, right? First,
yes.
coming to grips with this is who I am. What have I been delaying saying that for? And then saying it loud and proud as possibly can be said. This is who I am. Mm.
Yes, it's very much that. It's very, this is who I am. These are the boundaries I assert to define who I am. This is the tenderness I think I deserve. These are the connections that I yearn for. And this is the nuance I would like you to see. This is the allyship I welcome, that I ask for, and that I hope for. And like, it's all of the nuances of the Black lady narrative that maybe aren't really perpetuated in place of the strong Black woman paradigm or the over-sexualized Black woman back paradigm or the angry Black woman paradigm that is perpetuated most in the era of protesting, where no one's feeds have anyone that's melanated or with kinky hair until it's protest time. Then that's literally all you see. And then they disappear again. And the erasure of like all of the nuance of the moments in life between that. And I've wanted to tell the story that is in between those moments. Yes, there's a protest song on this record in Diamond Studded Shoes. Yes, like there's a sexy song in Starlight. Yes, there are these moments, but in my sexy moment, I also deserve connection and tenderness. And in my real life, I attain that. So why not tell that story?
And right. respect yes. at every one of those
yes.
points.
Yes, like 1,000%, you know, and it's so important, you know, to be able to say, you know, it's not just a trope that you're going to hear today, you know, it's going to be a nuanced story of an actual real person.
Well, you know, that title track, Stand For Myself, that's a real tour de force. And, you know, it reminds me of what you were just talking about, like this nuance, this ability to sing soft and kind of deliver something, and then when the moment comes, let them have it, right?
Yeah.
And it builds and builds to that moment, and it just takes your head off. Sentiment, it was easier to give in than stand for myself. That is a really, I think that, talk about a nuanced point. So you're living your whole life kind of giving in and conforming, right? And
yes.
People don't like confrontation, even with themselves, right? So how do you figure that out? How did you sort of say, like you said, your mother's funeral was kind of like an eye opener, but you know, here we are, 8 years later, and that song comes out.
Yeah.
So it was a process, right?
It was a it's a process. It's an all therapy, yeah. A process. Yeah. So I think like between grief counseling and just, I call it the 29 panic, that people get to 30 and they start going, I don't think any of this is sustainable. And they start getting really panicked and they start making big cuts in their life. Like, I can't have these people in my life. They're toxic. I can't do this. So people go through, a lot of my friends went through it at 29. And I think I went through it at 29 as well. I was like, this is all so toxic and unsustainable. And so like, I started making some pretty severe cuts. And I think like 5 people survived. And then I was like, who have I been talking to who's amazing, who just didn't demand my time because they were too lovely? That was kind of part of the process of that, was surrounding myself with people who also agreed that I deserve nuance and tenderness and respect and any form of empathy, you know? In the Black woman narrative, like, neglect is one of the most principal things you experience. Like, everyone's ready to neglect you. Everyone's ready to assume. And that is the kind of the caveat of the strong Black woman paradigm, is that you're seen as invincible, therefore able to endure all of the most dreadful things on planet Earth. Let's throw them all at her now. And then and then we can relieve any work we might have to do for ourselves regarding our bias, because as very astutely put by Greg, people especially don't like to have confrontations with themselves. Like, some people may be more willing to have confrontation with someone else so that they don't have to have a conversation with themselves.
Yeah.
Because paradigm shift is the hardest thing to achieve. And that's really what that song is about. It's about paradigm shift. It's about actually changing the way that you process information, that you think, and being less based in the amygdala and more in the prefrontal cortex. And so...
Right. Y'all are schooling us on everything. Now it's biology time.
Yeah, yes, exactly. It sure is. But, you know, they call it amygdala reflex, that when you're like, you're being reactional and it's all based on fear and that primordial brain. And like, people are encouraging people to that primordial brain and away from the analytical and that's what kind of boosts cortisol, and it's not helpful.
Well, as you said, there is a couple of great protest songs on this album. You're sitting talking to us in Nashville. You mm-hmm. have experienced the harshest experiences you can have in the UK, whether it was small-town racism or living for a time homeless in London.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, Yola, about your perspective as someone who knows both of these worlds, the US and the United Kingdom, about this Black Lives Matter moment and this new racial reckoning. How do you see it?
In my mind, obviously, I always think this is an even more interesting question to talk to with someone like Mavis Staples, who's been there marching. I don't
marching
know.
With Dr. King.
With
I know.
Dr. King. I wonder how you maintain such belief for such a long period of time. You're like, this time we're going to do it. This time. Okay, it wasn't this time. This time we're going to do it. Okay, it wasn't that time either. How about
50 years, 60 years. I know. Shouldn't this be done?
But also, like, I'm an English woman. And so I've come from the OGs. Like, you guys think you got it locked on racism? Oh, hell no. It came from us. We gave birth to you. We are like your tiny Mima. You're like our 6'8" grandchild. Like, who's just...
Yeah.
You know?
And then the Zulus showed those Brits at Isandlwana and Rockstrip. Take that.
Take that. And they did. But the funny thing is that... the way that we experience it in the UK is just different. We don't like to address things. So the idea of the worst thing we can do is address ourselves in any form of confrontation is especially poignant in the UK. Sometimes, especially where I was growing up, I would find people were in complete denial of the existence of a problem. And when people were dying or being killed, they'd just be burying it. So it would never be anywhere even near local news. And recently we've been seeing with BLM UK, them bringing some of these stories to light. And they go, wow, that's a lot of people dying in the UK that are black and brown. Mm. But you don't hear about it as much because we're far better at getting people to buy in and to brainwash. Because if you get them in the mind first, you don't need anything else. You don't even need guns. Ha ha! We managed to do it minus guns. You think we ain't good? We're the best.
Well, that's interesting to hear that perspective. But at least in America, we're talking about it.
Yeah. It makes such a massive difference that the second that people are at least admitting that it's there and it's real, you can actually find people who want to address it and then just work with them. If people are in such denial that it doesn't exist or are like, oh God, that was awkward, even address, oh God, no. Like, then you'll always have someone there, like with unchecked bias, waiting to affect your life. And for me, that has worked out extremely badly.
After the break, we'll continue our conversation with Yola and discuss her new album, Stand For Myself. That's next on Sound Opinions.
And we are back. This week, we're talking with Yola. Let's jump right back into the conversation.
I remember you walking out on that stage at South by Southwest in 2019, like a month after Walk Through Fire was released, with a guitar and that's it. It's going to be this singer and this guitar and her songs. And the whole room is just like, wow, this is incredible. But I didn't see that artist in 2019, as good as that record was, making this kind of record this year. Like, I was kind of blown away by, like, wow, this thing is just exploding. And I'm kind of trying to put my finger on it, Yola. Same producer, Dan Auerbach, you know, Nashville, whatever, recording sessions, right? What happened? I think it's a big leap.
It's a big leap.
Yeah.
You're 100% right. It's a massive leap. You've missed nothing. You're like, lyrically, it's a massive leap. Melodically, it's a massive leap. You're missing nothing. You've nailed it. You're right. And the difference is...
And she'd let you know if you were wrong.
I would. Here's what's different. The pandemic. And also, being in this country. So I lived in the UK right up until like, let's say January 2020. I was on tour here for 2 months. And then the idea was that I was going to, like, go on tour with Chris Stapleton. And we did do one show. And then I was going to go back to the UK and figure out whether I was going to split my time between here and the UK or move completely. I wasn't sure yet. Anyway, obviously, the after March didn't really happen. And so
you couldn't go back if you wanted to, right?
No, exactly. And I did need to make a record. So I couldn't actually go back, because otherwise there would have been definitely no record at Easy Eye Studio in Nashville. So I had to stay. And so inevitably, by the time we got to like 6 months into it, I'm like, I'm now clearly moving here, because we're now getting the idea that this is going to be long. So I live here, it's too late. So it was a matter of then figuring out how that works. And in that first kind of stint that we all did of being very isolated from each other, like, I had to be coming up with ideas. And the first record, I was commuting, doing the longest commute for, I know of anyone doing, from Bristol to Nashville on an airplane. And I would go into the studio and Dan would have a co-writer set up, and me and him and the other co-writer would sit down, we'd write the song. And that would be what would happen on the day. I wouldn't bring anything. We just made it in the room on the day. This record was the antithesis of that. It was songs I'd even played out to people. If I've been gigging up and down the UK, will recognize some of these songs because I'd played them, I'd been working on them, and they were changing as I was working on them. And so we continued that work and finished them, you know. Dumb Studded Shoes, I started writing in 2017 at Aaron Lee Tasjian's house. And we were just talking about like everything that was happening in the UK and the US at the time. And it just meant that that got more true. That song just got more relevant as time went on. I was like, God, I'm going to have to put this out. It's kind of like the most relevant thing I can think of right now. It ain't gonna turn out right. We know it isn't. We know it isn't. Oh, no, we know it isn't. That's why we got to fly. For the life and soul of the one we love. Fly. The promises that are gonna be in love. The pandemic crystallized like a state of mind for me that had clearly been happening for a very long time. And and so then all of these songs jumped out. I was like, I need to exist. I need to be finished. I need one. So I bring them. So I bring them forward. I'd be like, this has got fire. We need to finish it. And he was like, this is great. What does it need? I'm like, it needs like a bridge, okay? Or it needs like reworking the lyrics on the second verse. Like, I always get a first verse. I always slam a first verse. And then I'm like, help me sometimes. And I'm like,
I gotta finish, I need more.
So that was part of the process. And then the other part of it was being alone, actually, at 5 o'clock in the morning. And still, because I don't know if you saw my 2019 schedule, but it was a hellmouth. And so I wasn't remotely feeling. None of this got written in 2019 because it was impossible for me to be inspired. And it wasn't like I was trying to write even. And when I was like, oh, I wonder if anything's come out. It normally does. Nothing. And so like when I finally got to this piece, it was like I had a backlog. And so ideas just kind of start coming and percolating and like, I can't go into the room with anyone else. So I have to create this thing and then bring it to people and go, I feel like this has got fire. Can we finish it? Or I feel like this is just like a hook idea that we need to build an idea around. But like, so as a result, I'm responsible for way more of the chords than I was on the first record, more of the lyrics, all of the narrative, way more of the melodics as well, because of isolation.
The pandemic was good. It was good for at least one thing.
Yeah, it was.
We got the best out of Yola when the world ended.
Kind of. Yeah, basically. It was maybe a skosh less collaborative. And so if you like this, you like my musical journey through life because you hear bits of things like Countrified and whatever you want. But you also hear Britpop and whatever you want. And they sit together and you're like, how do they sit together? I'm like, an English person can do this because I heard them. It was my life. I understand.
Yeah, right.
You know, yeah. And so they're the things that you'll hear in the melody or in something that like maybe you won't have had the chance to hear in the first record because we were just all sitting in the room making it all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
Yola, let me ask you a question. It's unimaginable to me that anybody will not love this record, but if a critic did, I could hear them attacking you on the look, the production aesthetic, sometimes the sound is kind of rooted in a certain 60s ethos. Right? Northern Soul, they would have called it in Britain, right?
Yeah.
But that was just them loving Motown and Philadelphia Soul and Stax Volt, right? So if someone threw at you, why are you always looking backward to that era? Which I think the record is timeless. Like you just said, we can hear all of these things. But if they wanted to typecast you, and the music industry is notorious for this, you're standing for yourself. That's the title of the album. But they always want to put you in a box.
They really do. And I've named myself as genre fluid for exactly that reason. Like, it's very much of my life and of my time and of my experience of sitting down with my mother's records, being isolated because we were isolated. If anyone finds issue with the story, they just don't like me as a human being, and that's fine. Screw them.
Yep.
If you're like, could you be this now? Who's saying this? What's the percentage of critics that are white males?
Yeah,
lots.
A disgustingly, embarrassingly large percentage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So if we're navigating that, I think you should be this. I'm like, according to whose lens? That's problematic. Why do you have an issue with my connection to the diaspora? And what qualifies you to comment on that? That would be my first question, because clearly I have a connection through my mother. And now she's not here. That might be what's left of my connection. And so if someone has an issue with that, just knock yourself out, mate, like girls. Life is too short. It's too short.
Well, I got to ask one fluffy question, Yola, about the Baz Luhrmann movie. You're going to play, you were Sister Rosetta Tharpe. I mean, who, you know, okay, that's a natural fit.
I think
you belong in that
there.
In that movie.
Yes.
So this Elvis biopic got delayed by COVID, et cetera. Is it back on? Are you starting filming? What's up with that?
Okay, these are the things I can tell you. I've already filmed my scenes.
Oh,
hey. Yeah.
Okay.
We all went out. All the Beale Street Squad went out. That's wrapped. So these are things I can say. Like, we've wrapped. I shot my scenes. Some of the days were 15-hour shooting days. I had to learn to shred like her while simultaneously singing. Because, you know, most people, including Hendrix, would like shred and go do 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 do
and then sing.
Yeah.
And that hurt my brain so hard. But
well, you're offering some great musical insight into Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Yeah.
What a genius she was, right?
Exactly. That really, like, it felt like it was physical, that I needed time to actually start that actual physical brain separation so I could think about playing the guitar, singing what I had to sing, acting whilst singing, hitting my marks, interacting with Austin Butler, who's playing Elvis, interacting with Kelvin Harrison Jr., who's playing B.B. King, interacting with Alton Mason, who's playing Little Richard. I've got to be eye-banging these people and like actually having reactions and interactions whilst I'm shredding, whilst I'm singing at the same time as shredding. And I've never done that before in my life. So when you see me land these, and I do land them, when you see me land them, note how many hours that must have taken during the pandemic to get to that point.
Well, no, you know, there is that complicated seducing you and kicking you in the nuts.
Yes!
Don't mess with me, right? And you, Richard, you think you got this. I'm better than you, right? Well, I can shout louder, I can be wilder.
She discovered him. That was the thing that was interesting. And then while I'm like, that makes so much sense, because of the 50s, a white guy isn't discovering Little Richard with his makeup and how like his flamboyance and his borderline kind of queer like energy.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, yes, a queer woman would be like, oh, that's fine. And so
right.
They
related
like,
to each other.
Exactly. So I'm like, how does this guy exist in this time? Oh, so then we don't even get Prince if we don't get Sister Rosetta. Okay. These are the things that like you had to kind of study to be to embody and to like understand the power that you hold to bring that through the camera, you know? And so, yeah, like it was a lot of work. I am
certain you nailed it. I know. If you're telling us you nailed it, then I bet you nailed it.
Wow.
I had to say play these solos for 15 hours straight. So
what I did on my time off, you basically reinvented your entire career.
Other people bake bread.
Yes, you know.
We can't wait, Yola, until we get to see you play these songs live. It's an extraordinary album. It's a great accomplishment. You are 100% yourself.
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me. This has been an utter joy talking to you today.
Oh, very good.
Thank you, Yola.
It was our pleasure. That wraps up our conversation with Yola, although I think we could have talked to her for hours.
She was great.
Now we want to hear from you, our listeners. Have you heard Stand For Myself? Why not? Go listen now and then tell us what you think of it. Leave us a message on our website, soundopinions.org. The surprising death of Charlie Watts bumped our tribute to Don Everly, Greg, but I know we'll be paying tribute to him soon. What do we have on the show, though, next week?
Jim, next week we're going to play some songs that are about breaking free from something that's holding us down.
Yeah, one of our list shows. And this week on our bonus podcast, we heard more from that interview with Richard Thompson, another treat, and there's a special bonus podcast. I spoke with author Kathy Iandoli about her new book about Aaliyah, the artist and R. Kelly survivor. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this program belong solely to Sound Opinions and not necessarily to Columbia College Chicago or our sponsors. Thanks, as always, to our Patreon supporters. Sound Opinions is produced by Andrew Gill, Alex Claiborne, our intern is Sol Delgadillo, and our social media consultant is Katie Cott.